I found some points of light, if you will, some things that are encouraging in the midst of just this frank assessment of what life looks like for a lot of people. Sometimes for us, but the rest of the world living without Christ, this is what they see a lot. And it's a good reminder to us. It might help us think about how to connect with them and how to enter even into their world of suffering. So again, that's kind of the big overall goal for this whole thing, not just to study Ecclesiastes. I want to do that absolutely, and I want to do that with you, but also to study it so that you do something with it, so that it helps you see how the world around you, family members, neighbors, how they're thinking, what they're struggling with, and maybe it gives you an opportunity to just change slightly the way that you bring the good news of the gospel into their lives. So let's pray. Father, that's the goal stated for this group. Not just that we study your word, which is in and of itself profitable, and profitable for us, but rather we study it in such a way that you use it to be profitable to the world around us, that we would truly be salt and light, that you would give us wisdom to see needs, you would give us the wisdom to know how to meet them, whether it's to simply come alongside and befriend, whether it's to be with someone in a time of sorrow, or to speak words of comfort or truth or challenge. Father, we ask that you would use us to build your kingdom. And we ask this in Jesus' name and for his sake. Amen. All right, Solomon closes out chapter 3 with this statement. So I saw that there's nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his work. And then he begins chapter 4, and he introduces the better than statements. We're going to see these again in chapter 7, verses 1 through 12. This idea is seen in the book of Proverbs in a couple places. It's seen in, actually, in some of the apocryphal writings. It's seen also in some of the contemporary writings of other cultures in this time. And so Solomon is engaging in something that people, this idea, this kind of line of reasoning, this introduction to topics, it's something that they've been hearing just in the culture as well as in some of the sacred writings of the Proverbs, if they would hear any spoken to them or read to them, and here as well in Ecclesiastes. But I want to notice that right off the bat, in chapter 4, he begins like this. Again, I saw all the oppressions that are done under the sun. And then he immediately talks about the idea of the vanity of this, which comes up in a couple verses. But he's letting us know right off the bat what his perspective is as he's coming into this chapter. Again, I'm making the argument that he'll shift perspectives throughout Ecclesiastes. Sometimes he's speaking to us with a perspective under the heavens. That's when you see those markers, I would submit to you that he's saying, this is when you're thinking about the fact that we have a loving, sovereign God. Can't understand him all the time, that's to be sure. But we know at the end of the day, what he's doing is beautiful in its time. And under the sun is, this is just what life looks like if God's not involved. And so he's telling us the perspective that he's presenting for us. So verses 1 through 3 is kind of the first section. You can see in the notes that I've broken this down into 5 things. The 5 areas or the 5 ideas are flowing from those better than statements. The middle one, verses 7 and 8, there's nothing better here. They're not using that, but there's some other kind of markers that seem to indicate there's a slight shift in thought here. So that's how I came up with these 5 things. So verses 1 through 3, If somebody's willing to read that, and then we'll jump in and talk about this just a little bit. Chapter 4, verses 1 through 3. What an encouraging set of verses. All right. You know, it's he's picking up the theme of oppression again. He's talked a little bit about that in chapter 3 where he said, you know, justice is supposed to help those that are oppressed. When you're getting justice right, when a society gets justice right, there is an equal law, if you will. It's not who can pay for the best lawyer. It's really who has the best case. And so if somebody is without any means, if somebody has no friends, you would still think they could come before a judge who would listen to the case and decide with real equity and justice. Solomon's saying, I've looked all over the place. One of the things, you know, again, one of the points here is that folks that think there's no possible way that Solomon's involved in this at all, since he was the king, he could just change the justice system. And I think, well, one, it's not that easy ever anywhere, even if you are in charge. But the second thing is, if you remember, one of the things about Solomon is he engaged in a lot of political marriages. And so one of the things he could be saying is, not even necessarily speaking to injustice in his own kingdom, although I'm sure there was some of that, but look, I've seen governments around the world, and I've seen injustice there. And just because he married one of the daughters of one of the royal families in those kingdoms, he wouldn't have any ability to exercise his own sense of authority. Any way you look at it, this oppression that he's seeing is so bad that he's like, you know what? It's better for those that are already dead. Why is it better for those that are already dead? Well, he kind of answers that. Well, they don't have to see any more suffering. They don't. And then keeping that going, well, if that's the case, then it's probably even better for those that were never even born or haven't been born yet, is what Solomon's saying, because they haven't seen any of that suffering. Well, what's changed? What's different here? One of the reasons why I feel like this idea of other under the sun is if God's not involved is because there are some of the similar language that occurs in Lamentations chapter 1. If you want to turn there, I'll read just a couple verses. And here, the Lamentations are the Lamentations of Jeremiah. Okay? And listen to just a couple verses that he speaks about, which sound a lot like what we've just read. I won't read verse 2 and verse 9, but that's kind of part of it. I will read verse 16, 17, and 21. Lamentation 1:16. For these things I weep, and my eyes flow with tears, for a comforter is far from me, one to revive my spirit. Verse 17, Zion stretches out her hands, but there is no one to comfort her. The Lord has commanded against Jacob that his neighbors should be his foes. Israel has become a filthy thing among them. Verse 21, they heard my groaning, yet there is no one to comfort me. My enemies have heard of my trouble. They are glad that you have done it. You have brought this day that you announced. Now let them be as I am. One of the differences in this Lamentation of Jeremiah, and maybe it didn't come out quite so much, but if you'd back up and maybe even look at 15, one of the things that Jeremiah is really clear about is he's saying, Lord, you're involved in this. You're still Lord and you're still God. And I'm feeling oppression in my life. And I don't feel like there's anyone to comfort me. How can this be? And just that realization, just that honesty, just that declaration that God, as odd as it may seem, he is involved, makes all the difference. There is no hinting. There's no indication when the lament occurs here in chapter 4 of Ecclesiastes that God is involved in that. I think that's what's changed. That's the perspective that's changed. You can look at Job chapter 10, verses 1 and 3, verses 18 and 19. Let's see. I think I won't read that, but you can jot it down for your own study if you want to. And Job himself is saying, Lord, why is this happening to me? I don't understand that this is happening to me. It doesn't seem just. Why do you let the wicked prosper? That's a lament that you hear again and again through the Psalms, through some of the Proverbs, just this idea. But the difference is, when we recognize that God is involved. If we don't see that God is involved, then there's actually some logic to the thought here. Boy, you know, if life is just about suffering, if that's all there is, what is the point? It's better for those that have already passed away because they don't have to see the horrible things that are about to come. It's probably even better for those that have not yet been born. What a contrast to a couple verses we looked at last week, chapter 3, verses 11. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Verse 13. Also, well, I perceive that there is nothing, in verse 12, nothing better for them to do than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live, that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all their toil. This is God's gift to man. Verse 22 of chapter 3. So I saw that there's nothing better, that a man should rejoice in his work, for that's his lot. A perspective change really makes all the difference. So could anything be better? Well, certainly, without God in the picture, life doesn't even seem to be better. Verses 4 through 6 kind of introduce the next idea here. I'll read these. Then I saw that all toil and all skill and work come from a man's envy of his neighbor. This is also vanity and striving after wind. The fool folds his hands and eats his own flesh. Better is a handful of quietness than two handfuls full of toil and a striving after the wind. The writer here, Solomon's saying, first in verse 4, he speaks to what I'm going to call the cancer of envy. This is true for a lot of folks, verse 4. It's true for a lot of believers as well, if we're honest. And I think of my own life as a chaplain. One of the big mistakes that I made early on and for a long time, really, was not just to be the best chaplain that I could be, but I really wanted to be better than my peers. And so that meant I said yes to my boss on a lot of stupid things, and I probably should have been at home loving my wife and children. But honestly, it was this idea. Toil and skill and work come from a man's envy of his neighbors. It was a goal of mine to be recognized as superior to my peers. The military loves that system. They set it all up. You get evaluated every year. You get written performance ratings. You get scores on anything, on everything. You get to wear a salad, on your chest, which speaks of all the things that you've done, and there's a lot of accolades there. And they want that for good reason. They're perfectly fine with infantrymen charging the battlefield, trying to last a little longer, shoot a little straighter, be a little more rugged than their peers. It's, in some sense, what our nation needs. But at another level, it's like a cancer. You know, seeing my peers instead of colleagues in the ministry as competitors for the number one stratification, which is a big deal in the military. And I'll confess that even as a professionally, religious person, a professional chaplain and a minister of the gospel, I found that my life was being controlled in some sense by this envy. And you have to realize that it's vanity. It's truly vanity, because even if you're really good, if you just keep, you know, widening your scope, your perspective of who you're comparing yourself to, you're going to lose at some point. And even if you might be technically better than everyone in the world in something, when you see their Facebook posts, you've totally lost, right? Because then they get to adjust their own reality, you know, and just show you it's an edited photo of whatever it was they saw or experienced, or, you know, a latte they drank. So that was my first exposure to all that stuff. All my friends were telling me about coffee drinks that they had. I'm like, really? So much better than the coffee I was drinking, I'm sure. But that's the thing. You know, envy is a cancer, and it will eat you alive. Proverbs 14:30 says, envy makes the bones rot. You know, what's interesting is if you look at the word envy, every single time that it's used, you know, as I studied it, it talks about something destructive, with one exception. And that's when Paul says, there are some people that preach out of envy, and as long as they get the gospel message right, I'm still thankful to the Lord. But every other time envy is used, something destructive is happening, either in one's life or around them. One of the reasons that it's stated that Christ was crucified, or that the priests, you know, and all of the religious leaders of the day wanted him crucified, in that list, it's in multiple gospels, envy is chief among them. Envy will destroy us. The next, in verse 5, we see the self-destruction of idleness as well. Proverbs 19:15 says, you know, the idle will suffer hunger. Of course, the irony here is they're not suffering hunger, but they are eating their own flesh, which doesn't sound any better to me. And that's a really limited supply anyway. It's, you know, and then Paul, and this is just it's not just an Old Testament concept of, you know, you have to work. You know, if you don't work, you shouldn't eat. It's also a New Testament concept. Paul actually warns against people in the church. And he says, he gives a warning to the Christians against those who are idle. He speaks about that to the Thessalonians in his first letter, and then in the second letter, chapter 3, two times, verses 6 and verse 11. He's saying, you need to be careful of people that are just idle. And so one is, you know, obviously they're not building anything to benefit anyone else, but they're not even engaged in building in their own lives. And so as a result of that, they've got nothing to do except for causing problems in the church. And then next in verse 6 is kind of the first glimpse in this text of some hopeful or helpful advice. It's better is a handful of quietness than two hands full of toil in a striving after wind. There's a lot of different ways to look at this verse, and different commentators speak about it a little bit differently. But I read this and I see it as a beautiful midway between the cancer of envy, where you're literally grabbing for everything you can get, and you know, like you've got both hands, and you're reaching in there, and it's all spilling out, and you're not even satisfied with that. And the idle person whose hands are empty. Verse 5, the fool folds his hands and then eats his own flesh. So it's like, I've got nothing in them. Solomon is saying, better is a handful, one hand full of quietness, rather than two hands. Well, actually, he doesn't even say your hand is full. It's just, well, a handful of quietness is better than two hands full of toil and a striving after wind. We'll dive into this a little bit more. This is a theme that he's going to repeat in chapter 9, verses 7 to 10, and chapter 11, verses 1 to 10. So two more times he's going to speak of this idea of why it's wise to pursue a quiet and peaceful life, if you will. And there's New Testament passages that speak to that. But the point here is you are better if you have a little bit of something that's great rather than being consumed with this idea to have everything. And then he's kind of plays with that or keeps that same idea going as he moves into this next section in verses 7 and 8. Would somebody be willing to read verse 7 and verse 8? All right. This is not an indictment on singleness. It's not. This verse, just like the next one in nine, the next section, 9 through 12, it's not talking about marriage. There are principles, either way, that you can apply to be sure. But this is speaking about vanity in living for oneself. The vanity in which if your focus on life is for your own accumulation, your own wealth, your own self-advancement, your own everything is just your own. And the irony here is that in verse 8, we're talking about a person who has no other. Like there's no one else in this person's life. And even so much to say, not even son or brother. In other words, not even family. There's no one in this person's life. And yet, there is no end to all his toil. And his eyes are never satisfied with riches. So the picture that Solomon wants you to have is somebody who's completely by themselves, cut off, maybe literally doesn't have any family, maybe they've all passed away, but more likely just cut himself off from everyone, you know, so that they can truly be king in their own castle. But there's only one problem with this person. They're so focused on themselves that they've lost the ability to see good, to enjoy good, to benefit from any of their work. And so they've got all this, ridiculous work ethic, I suppose. It's ridiculous because it's all-consuming, and yet they have no ability to be satisfied. So there's no end to all of his toil, and yet he's never satisfied. And in fact, he's so dysfunctional that he's not able to ask this question, for whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure? Like, who am I doing all this for? I'll tell you one thing. When my wife and I got married, she was a registered nurse. I was in college. So guess who made all the money in our household? And I was perfectly fine with that. It was wonderful to have her work so hard for me. Oh, I'm so glad you laughed. So that would have been awkward. But And I still had 1 year left of college, and the Lord gave us a gift of a child pretty early on. And so I still hadn't finished college. In fact, Isabel attended my college graduation. She was a couple weeks old, something. And when I looked at that dear little girl's face, I had a new sense of responsibility. And one of the things that helped me realize was not that I just wanted to, you know, one day be able to provide for my wife, but I needed to provide for this little child. And it was powerful, and it was powerfully motivating to me. I'm guessing that there are people in your lives that you strive for, and that's a healthy thing. They may be direct family, they may be adopted family, they may be neighbors that you've just grown an appreciation for and you labor for their benefits. It may be a missionary endeavor that you have a certain sense of calling for, a ministry that you say, I can spend myself for these people. I'm willing to be, you know, involved in the mess of their lives or roll up my sleeves and participate in their brokenness, or come alongside of them in their times of joy as well. And all of those things is so much better than one who is self-focused and has cut himself off from all relationship and has lost pleasure. There's no surprise that this is also vanity. And this is also an unhappy business. If this guy had at least the perspective of being able to ask the question, then he would say, no one. Well, what am I doing this for? And hopefully that would change their perspective. Again, there are people in our lives that they don't even think about this stuff. They're so absorbed in their work. They're so numbed by the entertainment culture of today that they're not even thinking about who are they laboring for and who can they be a blessing to. And so that's the charge here. Well, verses 9 through 12 take us to the next section here, which is kind of, I've titled, Better Not to Be Alone. And again, just want to say, it's not a passage on marriage. You can apply the principles that we're going to talk about, absolutely. But this isn't just saying, oh, being single is horrible in the last section. I mean, being married is great. That's not what this is saying. The picture that we're trying to, that I believe Solomon wants to give us is a journey through a wilderness. Like literally, a couple folks walking through the wilderness. And they're involved in some kind of lengthy travel and perhaps even some sort of endeavor together, some project that they're trying to accomplish. So that's the picture that I believe that we should have in mind as we read through these. So here's 9 through 12. I'll read these. Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their toil. If they fall, one will lift up his fellow. Woe to him who is alone when he falls and has not another to lift him up. Again, if two lie together, they keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. So if you kind of see it with the journey picture, or, you know, working together on a project, a lot of these really make sense. And this is why, again, principles can work in here in marriage. Two are better than one. They have a good reward for their toil. If anybody's been involved in a startup business or working retail or working in some sort of customer service thing, the second person is so helpful. You know, if you're just one person and you're trying to work a counter and then there's somebody there and the phone rings, customer service is being denied to one or the other. Or if you've got a second person, you know, that you can take care of that. Somebody else walks in, just a simple smile, and I'll be with you in just a moment. If you're by yourself, you can be flustered there. There's also plenty of things in terms of just manually intensive labor that two people can do so much better than one. Lifting a log in place on a house or trying to build something. And you're like, let's see. I wish I could use, you know, another person to hold up that end while I get this one straight. Is a tremendous blessing. And so we see, I've mentioned that there's a couple things. One is there's a good reward for their toil. Two people working together well can certainly double the amount that's produced. There's this rescue that takes place. That's the second one. They can encourage and support each other. A lot of the commentators mention that the idea of falling here, the same language is used a lot of falling into a pit. And so they're like, literally, if you accidentally fall into a pit that was dug to try to trap some animal, you're in trouble if you're by yourself. If you add a second person there, they're like, whoa, I won't step there. Can I help? You know, and literally pull you out. Otherwise, you're stuck just waiting. So that's this rescue idea. But I think the principle here is also there's just this support and encouragement that can take place. We all have days in which we feel like we've fallen. And if you have a second person there, they can rescue you in those days as well. The third point that I see is they can gain sustenance or warmth, literally, from each other. Again, it's that idea of journeying. And I, you know, this is like danger close to all sorts of troubling thoughts here. Let's just keep it in marriage, right? It's so much easier. But really the idea is, hey, if you're traveling together in a desert, and you can't build a fire because you can't find any wood, you can, if there are two of you, you can keep each other warm. And that's just a reality, and it's also a principle. There are times in which one of us, we just physically don't have enough capacity, whether it's to create, you know, the British thermal units or whatever, some measure of heat, or if it's the ability to just, whatever that project is, whatever that emotional energy we need, a physical energy we need, a social interaction we need to have, we can be lacking. And a second person in our life can provide that what lacks in us, whether it's warmth on a cool night or just the encouragement or the right word at the right time. And for all of those reasons, and you know, even more, they're just literally stronger together. They can defend each other. Are there any dark alleys in Kalispell? Any place where people are? So, no? Okay. Well, I grew up right outside of Baltimore, and there are dark alleys in Baltimore. And, you know, you can, if you're taking a walk, the difference in walking through places that are unfamiliar, uncomfortable, dark, and like ominous, whether it's really a problem or not, doesn't matter. Once your, you know, imagination takes off, you're like, oh, what's going to happen? This is a new mall. All these stores are closed or whatever, you know, and you just start getting yourself. Any time that I had a second person there, I never felt that. I remember as a young kid walking out to feed the horses. So this is far removed from the, you know, the inner city of Baltimore. But the path was 100% wooded on one side, deep, dark woods, and like grass on the other. And so during the day, I would just like walk right down the lane and, you know, be just this close to all the forest. But at night, I may be walking to the barn a little. I just wanted a little space in case somebody would jump out at me. But when I had a friend from high school and we were going to feed the horses together, I never even felt that. I never felt that fear. And Solomon's making the same point here, which we know. Two people are just stronger together. And if you've got three, that's a cord that's not going to be broken easily. So it's better not to be alone. So one of the problems, you know, this idea that Solomon's speaking through here is in verses 7 and 8, you have somebody that's not just alone, but is like hyper alone. Like everything about them is self-focused. And that's bad. Better to have other people in your life and benefit from that. And then in verse 13 to 16, there's still this tone of denouncing the folly, if you will, of self-sufficiency. But he does it in a different way. And so chapter or verses 13 to 16, would somebody be willing to read at least two verses of that, 13 and 14? Thank you. You get extra credit for reading two more verses. So that's awesome. This is one of the sections. There's a couple others where it really feels like it has a historical ring to it. And so the historians and the commentators are like, oh, he's giving us a clue here. Okay, we're going to know who the author is. Somebody was born poor, then ended up as king. Somebody who spent some time in prison. And then, let's see, who could this be? And so they're just racking their brains. And there's a couple things to think about. One is the idea of being in prison. Most all the commentators, the theologians here, agree that this is probably speaking about debtor's prison, which is something. Do we still have a debtor's prison in America? Yeah, I don't think so. But back in the day, if you owed money, they would throw you into jail until you could pay it off. Not really sure how that ever really worked, but it did serve as a warning to people to be more fiscally responsible. And so that's likely the prison that they're talking about here, because they've mentioned this idea that they're poor on multiple times. The other thing about prison in those days is most of the times you were thrown into prison, most of the charges were kind of political or economic. And so it was basically just because of the injustice in the situation, because you weren't in favor of whatever the ruling party was, and you were poor, so you didn't have the means for any real justice, you would find yourself in jail. We recently watched The Count of Monte Cristo, and there's that funny scene where he and the dude in the cell, 200 yards down the road that worked an escape tunnel into his. And, what are you in for? Oh, they accused me of supporting Bonaparte. That's funny. I'm in here because I opposed him. And so you've got these two guys in prison forever, one because he supported Bonaparte and the other because he opposed him. Just a great analogy of how odd and how unjust the system can be. But in our case here, we've got an interesting better. Better was a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king. By the way, there are a lot of couplets in the Old Testament that this could fit with. This could fit with Joseph and Pharaoh, for example. This could fit with Solomon as, believe it or not, the old and foolish king, and either one of his sons as the young and upstart son. It could fit with a couple others as well. It may just be like hypothetical, or he may actually have been sharing from his own situation or a couple that he was thinking about. But there's something's been twisted here. And typically, passages like Leviticus 19:32 speak of the fact that there's wisdom in the graying, if you will, of one's hair. Like, with age comes wisdom. So I don't know what happens when it falls out, but with the graying, when you look at someone that's lived, that's walked, that's seen, that's experienced, that's persevered, you have wisdom there. So, a principle here, if you don't have gray in your hair, find someone that does. Yeah, and talk to them about life. And if you're coming up on a big decision, and whatever, that feels big to you, make sure that you're talking to somebody that has gone through that kind of a situation. Gain wisdom from our elders. One of the things I love about Presbytery, which is Lloyd and I just spent a great week down there, was they always, fathers and brothers. Fathers and brothers. And so anytime a presbytery needs to address the whole group, they call them fathers and brothers. And I think that's a great reminder of the recognition of the wisdom that's in a room like that. And it's not a math equation exactly, because the scriptures also indicate that there are times at which a person begins to lose their ability, perhaps, to recall all of the information. And so one needs to be discerning about that. And so Ecclesiastes here is making reference to that as kind of like, sometimes that seems to fall away. But what's tragic here is that it's falling away faster than it should. Yeah, I know. I've only got 2 minutes left. And that's just my iPhone technology telling me I need to wrap it up, land the plane. And so we have this double reversal. There's this poor, wise youth who thinks he's better than this old and foolish king. Now, the reality is the old king may not actually be that much of a fool yet, but he is on the decline. And the youth is on the rise. And he rises to power while this king fades away, and he feels great about it. But there's an irony that I think Solomon is speaking to here or addressing. And it's like this, chapter 1, verse 6. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north, and around goes the wind, and on its circuit the wind returns. Verse 9. What has been will always be. What has been done is what will be done. Verse 11, there is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to come. So the irony here is this pattern is going to repeat itself. There are some young, poor folks that are sure they're wiser than their elders, and they're oblivious to the fact that they too will be elders, and they will fade away. And so without God in the picture, without seeing the advantage of age and wisdom, without seeing that the Lord gives us people in our lives like that, the New Testament is full of that advice to the older women to teach the younger, to the older men to teach the younger. Without God in the picture, it is vanity. And so we've just looked at a couple of these things: envy, loneliness, injustice, the reversals of fortune. They can all cause doubting, and they do cause doubting for the people that you interact with. They cause doubting in your own life from time to time when you lose perspective of a merciful, loving, gracious, sovereign God on the throne who has promised that his work is not finished in you. And so the challenge for us is to, in our own lives and in the lives of those around us, look for ways to shift that perspective back under the heaven. That's the key. And that's chapter 4. And I did a lot of talking today, so thank you for your forbearance. Let me close out in prayer. Father, thank you again for your word. And just thank you for its riches and its depth, which really can't be exhausted, especially in just 45 minutes. Lord, work this into our lives as we have need. And thank you again for this opportunity to study. In Jesus' name, amen.